Welcome to Shorties, a short true crime story.
Hello.
Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday to you.
I am so excited to hear this episode because I saw you writing it and you said it's really emotional.
It's super emotional. It's such a moving story. It's like the epitome of moving and inspiring, and it doesn't matter if you relate to the content. You can't help but be just so moved by it. Mm-hmm. So I hope I'm not going to cry. I don't know.
I'll say I hope you do.
I ran through it a couple times and I didn't cry, so I'm hoping that I don't cry when I'm doing it here. But
there's nothing wrong. Let it out.
Okay.
This gets cathartic. Okay.
What if I just start sobbing right here?
That's all I needed to hear.
Thank you. Okay, so you ready?
Yes, ready.
It's 3 a.m. on June 21st, 2002, and 24-year-old Bridget Kelly has just returned to her apartment in Killeen, Texas. A friend of hers had arrived on a late flight, and Bridget had agreed to do the pickup and drop off because her friend was getting in so late she didn't want her to take like a cab. So when Bridget gets home, she arrives at her apartment complex and no one is around. She parked in her usual spot. She walked inside and shut the door behind her. Bridget lived alone, so she had a total of 4 locks on her front door. The chain, 2 deadbolts, and the door handle.
My girl. Yes. That is me.
Yeah. All of which she obviously promptly locked when she shut the door behind her. So she started slowly getting ready for bed, kind of puttering around, taking out her contacts, washing her face, putting on her sweats and stuff like that. And as she's walking down the hallway towards her bedroom, she heard a loud noise coming towards the entryway. So she walks to the front door and looks through the peephole just in time to see a man that she doesn't know step back from the door and then charge full force at it. Despite all of the locks, he kicked the door in. It happened so fast, Bridget didn't even have time to step away. The door hit her square in the face, knocking her back several feet where she landed on the ground. And suddenly the man is inside of her apartment, standing over her, pointing a gun in her face. He said all he wanted was money, so she handed over her purse, but it only contained $40 in cash. So he grabbed her car keys and told her that they needed to go get more. She followed him outside, and she's desperately looking around for anyone who might help. But, you know, it's like 3 a.m., so no one was outside. No one was looking out their apartment windows. She felt completely under his control, and so she followed him. And then she realizes she's following him. He's walking ahead of her directly to her car. So this means he was hiding in the shadows, and he watched her when she arrived, parked, and walked inside. Her apartment complex was gated, but the entry gate was currently broken and left wide open. He orders her to sit down on the passenger seat, and they start driving. Bridget is so terrified. And something inside of her told her that this man was not bluffing with the gun. She said that she felt as though she had entered a different reality that wasn't her own. She said, you know, when something startles you and you gasp, you're suddenly in a different reality of panic where something bad is about to happen. You're stuck there for a few seconds, but then it passes and you breathe out a sigh. And now you're back in your reality. She said it felt just like that, except she was trapped in the gasp. She was trapped in the reality where something bad was happening. Without thinking, she started to pray Hail Mary full of grace out loud, but the man had no reaction and just kept driving. She wanted to humanize herself to him, so she started to tell him about herself. She told him that she's a first grade teacher at a nearby school. She told him that she loved teaching children to read. She told him that she loves children's literature. She asked him if he had any special teachers growing up. She asked if he had a favorite book as a little boy. And when he didn't respond to any of her prompts, she said, quote, "When I was young, I loved Peter Rabbit. Do you remember that story?" The man ignored her, and they arrived at an ATM. She said that it was a freestanding ATM in the middle of a giant deserted parking lot. He ordered her to get out and withdraw as much as possible. The max amount allowed to withdraw was $200, so that's what she took out. She desperately looked around for signs of life, but they were completely alone. So she was suddenly in a very unusual predicament because This was the first moment she was separated from him. He had stayed in the car and she was quite a distance from him. But again, she knew deep down that she would be shot to death if she tried to call his bluff. So she returned to the car and handed over the cash. The man began driving away, and a new wave of panic washes over her when she realizes he's driving in the opposite direction of her apartment. So she started spiraling. She's imagining all of the horrible places he might be taking her, and then all of the horrible things that could happen to her once they were there. And then he pulls off to their side of the road, and they arrive in this massive empty field. It's pitch black and there is nothing and no one in sight. Have you ever been to Texas before?
Once. Yeah, once.
Okay, it is vast.
Yeah.
Like, Texas is the epitome of vast. So if there is a big, empty, open field, I mean, it has the ability to look like it just goes for like miles forever. And miles and miles and miles. And then
you feel completely alone.
Yeah. He continued driving into the field for what felt like hours, when in reality it was probably only a minute or two. The area was so dark and so vast that it felt like they were entering a void, leaving humanity behind. And then he stopped the car, and without even thinking, she said, quote, "A lot of people love me." She knew she was moments away from dying, and she realized that all that mattered was that she had been loved in this life. The man ignored her remark and told her to get out of the car and undress. As she did what she was told, her ATM card fell onto the ground, and she thought to herself, "That's how they'll identify my body." And then she ran for her life. He caught up to her immediately and tackled her to the ground. She lay there motionless as he pointed the gun at her with one hand and undressed himself with the other. She kept thinking to herself, "If I survive this, I'm going to be a rape victim." A realization that no one wants, but many have. During the assault, she started plotting her next moves. She knew if she kept her head together, she had a better chance at surviving. She knew she was seconds away from dying, but she kept plotting anyways. And when it was over, he told her to stand up and face away from him. And even still, she's plotting how to survive this. He fired a single shot that grazed her on the side, and she screamed as she fell to the ground. She laid there motionless as he walked closer and stood above her. He shot her again, this time in her lower back. The bullet hit her spleen, her colon, her liver, her diaphragm, and her stomach. But because she had just been plotting and plotting and plotting, and she expected him to do this, she didn't make a sound. She let her body roll with the impact of the bullet, but she was quiet so that he would think that she had already died from the first bullet. She heard him walking away back towards the car, but then he stopped and turned, and almost as an afterthought, shot her a third time for good measure. And again, she didn't make a sound. He got in her car and drove away, leaving her in this field naked, defiled, believing that she was dead. But as soon as she couldn't hear the car anymore, Bridget got up on all fours and started to crawl. Attempting to crawl was so painful that she immediately collapsed back to the ground. She laid there in the dirt and started thinking about her family, how they were sound asleep thousands of miles away with no idea what was happening to her. She felt the blood on her abdomen and wondered if she would ever have babies. She thought about her 3-month-old niece, Jenna, and how, if she died, Jenna would have no memory of Bridget. And then she thought to herself, "I'm only 24. This isn't supposed to be the end of my life right now by myself in this place." She knew that she had moments to live, so she stood up. She took a few steps and then collapsed back to the ground. And then something, a voice inside of her or some kind of force inside of her, propelled her forward. She got back up and she started to run, but it felt like someone else was holding her up, pushing her forward. Then she sees lights, and she realizes she's running towards a subdivision. She became laser-focused and just kept thinking, "There are people in there who will help me." Bridget gets to the subdivision and collapses at one of the front doors. She's yelling, she's banging on the door and ringing the bell, and the owner rushes to open it. It was a retired 20-year Army veteran named Frank James. He knew immediately that her wounds were bullet holes, And just by inspecting them, he knew she wouldn't survive. He called 911, covered her with a blanket, and held her until paramedics arrived. Bridget said that when she looked at Frank's face as he opened the door and saw her, she knew immediately that he was a father. Frank later told a reporter that he reacted as anyone would, and he hoped if it was his daughter, someone would have done the same for her. Bridget doesn't believe that it was coincidental that it was Frank's house that she landed at. She said he was a soldier, and in that moment, she needed a soldier. She believes it was God that propelled her forward in that field and guided her to Frank's door specifically, a man that she now refers to as her hero and very own guardian angel. Bridget was rushed to the hospital, where she immediately went into a 6.5-hour life-saving surgery. Doctors said that it was a miracle the bullets missed her heart and her spine, and that if she had arrived at the hospital even 10 minutes later, she would have died. Can you believe that? Like a matter of just
minutes.
It's unbelievable. When Michael Kelly got the call that his daughter was in the hospital after having been raped and left for dead, he dropped everything to get to her. Michael was a reporter for the Omaha World Herald, and the paper provided a private jet to get him to his daughter as fast as possible. When he walked into the hospital room, Bridget's eyes were open, but he said the sparkle was gone. She looked like she had seen hell. So after a long bout of crying, obviously, Bridget, who couldn't speak because of the tube down her throat, motioned to her dad that she wanted to write. So he handed her his reporter's notepad and a pen, and she scribbled, "Dad, I was thinking about you and Mom and my whole family when it was happening. I just wanted to see you again." Michael informed her that his paper was planning on covering the story of her attack and that he would be the one writing the article. But because they would list her name as a victim, they would not include the detail that she had been raped. She took the paper and pen again and wrote, "It's okay if they say rape." So he explained to her that it was actually the paper's policy, as well as many other news outlets, that a victim's name is never printed alongside the word rape. You either print that the victim was raped and leave out the name, or you print the name and leave out the word rape. After 2 major surgeries and 3 months of intense healing, Bridget made a full recovery and even returned to work. By then, Michael's paper had already released an article on Bridget's attack, but it said she was only abducted, robbed, and left for dead. This was something that really rubbed Bridget the wrong way. She felt like withholding her name suggested that it was shameful to admit to being raped, and she didn't agree with that. She said to her dad, quote, "Why is it more shameful to be a rape victim than it is to be a gunshot victim? If you're going to tell the story, then tell the whole story."
Amen.
So after lots and lots of meetings, pushing, Michael's editors at the paper relented and allowed him to write a very powerful, transparent piece on her attack titled, "A Plea for More Openness on Rape," with the first line reading, "Now you don't have to read between the lines and wonder. My daughter was raped." He acknowledges and agrees with Bridget's sentiment that being raped shouldn't be shameful, and he goes on to say, quote, "There is shame in rape, and it rests squarely with the attacker, not the victim. Historically, though, society unfairly has made many rape victims feel either that they contributed to the attacks or that they are somehow diminished, stigmatized, merely by being victims. The stigma from this awful crime should be on the predator, not on the prey. Sexual violation is not sex, it's violence. It's not love, it's hate. It's not so much an act of lust as of power and control. Because rape is such a personal and despicable act, it is natural for victims and their families not to talk. But perhaps in the long run, that works to the advantage of the attacker and to the detriment of the victim," unquote. Bridget and Michael's goal with this piece was to encourage survivors to talk about their experience and to let them know that they weren't alone. Michael said it was incredible the amount of letters and emails and cards and notes that they received from rape survivors. He said it was almost as if they had been waiting for someone to give them the okay that they could talk about what happened to them. And for Bridget, she said that receiving all of those letters proved to her just how common rape is, and yet it's still treated like a secret. But just to show how difficult it is to change society's backwards views on how we treat rape survivors and how ingrained this backwards logic is in some people, A few weeks after the piece was published, Michael was invited by MSNBC to take part in a live discussion on national television about when, if ever, is it appropriate to publish or broadcast the names of rape victims. A former CNN vice president named Ted Kavanaugh said during the discussion, and knowing who Michael was and why he was present, this guy Ted said that the stigma of rape will never go away. He said, quote, "It's always going to be there. Women who are raped in almost every single culture are considered damaged goods."
Wait, didn't Ted Kavanaugh assault women?
No, that's Brett Kavanaugh.
This is how rumors start, yeah. On my end. Sorry, Ted.
So this kind of attitude only cemented Bridget's desire to change this way of thinking. And 7 months after her attack, she partnered with the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault for a public safety campaign. In the video, Bridget returns to the field where she was attacked, and standing tall and looking into the camera, she bravely told her story. After the video was released, calls to the Texas Rape Hotline went up by 200%. Bridget began advocating for rape survivors and told her story publicly several times. Bridget's passion is teaching and always will be, but in her spare time, she's become a trained volunteer who sits with and offers support to rape survivors and their loved ones in the hours after the attacks. When speaking about her experience, Bridget said that a year before her attack, she would have said that she didn't know any rape survivors. But afterwards, when she learned, you know, how many friends and family came to her and confided that they also had been raped, mm-hmm. but had never talked about it, she realized she actually knows many, and that we actually all know many. She said, quote, "When you're talking about rape, you find out after talking about it that there's a little secret club that you never wanted to belong to. But once you're there, you're glad that you're not alone." I just want to acknowledge that this story is Bridget's, and I've intentionally told it that way. Her attacker deserves no fame or no recognition, so I'm not even going to name him. But what I will say about him is, he was an 18-year-old that Bridget did not know. In the day after her attack, while she was in surgery, police arrested this piece of shit when he returned to the scene of the crime in her car with his friends to show off her dead body. And instead, he found police in a crime scene. He was convicted of all charges and sentenced to life in prison plus 40 years. In 2004, ABC News featured Bridget's story during a primetime segment with Charles Gibson. And a producer named Eric Strauss was tasked with shooting footage of her in her home and in her classroom in Texas. Bridget and Eric became friends and kept in touch. And a few years after the segment aired, Bridget moved to New York for a master's program. Living in the same city for the first time, she and Eric went from being friends to falling in love. And on July 7th, 2012, they got married. During the ceremony, Eric told his bride, quote, "You revealed yourself to be a beautiful warrior the second I met you. With your regal elegance, insightfulness, and compassion, you inspire me to be better." In an article for the Omaha World Herald, Bridget's dad, Michael, wrote another piece on her story. In it, he notes that Bridget's attack took place from 3 a.m. to 4 a.m., an hour in which all she thought about was future life. And when her attacker left her in the field, she touched her abdomen and wondered, "Will I ever have babies?" 12 and a half years later, on February 7th, 2015, Bridget brought a new life into this world at approximately 3:35 a.m. She and Eric named their new son Joshua. And the following day, Bridget read his first story to him, The Tale of Peter Rabbit. And that is the incredible survival story of Bridget Kelly.
Jeez. Jeez. Just feel like I was trying not to cry the whole time. That was really well.
Oh, me too.
That was
me
really
too.
Well told.
I think it was so brave of her to come forward and share her story, and then not only to share it, but to advocate the way that she has, yeah. of, you know, trying to remove the stigma of surviving rape, because it's like her dad was saying, it's, you know, society has put all of this shame on the victim. Like, I can't fathom how that ever came to be. I don't understand that.
Well, it's men like that Ted guy.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, thousands, millions of others that make you feel like if you've been assaulted, then you're not wife material or mom material. Like you are all of a sudden this, you know, you're damaged goods.
Damaged goods, like you said.
And any man that thinks that you are less than because you were violated is not a man at all.
No, not at all. And I applaud her for coming forward. I applaud her for sharing her story because it empowers so many others to do the same. But I don't want anyone to misconstrue that as, you know, you're not brave if you don't come forward. Nope. Everyone can process their own experiences in whatever way that they need. And that might mean completely privately. That might mean only confiding in a couple people. It might mean not going to the police, and that's their business. But it's wonderful what she's done because she's really opened the door to having a conversation. You know, nobody shames a murder victim.
No.
Everyone just talks about how awful it is that they were victimized. So then why, when somebody attacks you physically and assaults you, would anybody shame them for that?
Just because there is so much shame around sex in general. Like, it's like if you show too much, you're one way. If you don't show enough, if you're too much of a prude, there's no winning when it comes to the topic of sex, I think, as a female in today's world or in, you know, all years past. And hopefully that's something that can improve. And I hope it improves for our children's sake and the people that we love that come after us. And it starts with women like her.
And it also starts with men. We have to teach boys.
Of course, yeah.
About consent and all of that. And it's a group effort. It's everybody. But I'm so proud of her.
Me too. Thank you so much for sharing that story.
Thank you for listening.
Anytime.
Well, again tomorrow?
Again tomorrow, probably.
Yeah,
okay. Love you.
I love you.
Bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy listening. We owe everything to the many journalists, authors, filmmakers, psychiatrists, and psychologists whose extensive work and expertise we pulled from to share this episode with you. To view detailed source material, as well as content from today, please visit us on Instagram and TikTok at Shorties Podcast. We really love doing this show, and if you'd like to help with the continued creation of it, you can support by donating to our Patreon, patreon.com/shortiespodcast. This episode was hosted by Ashley Brumley Johnson and Anna Katharina.